Let me just begin with a small introduction. And I always tell this story because I think it's relevant, even though I haven't yet exactly put together the argument why it's relevant. I've been teaching Introduction to Logic in Israel for 30, 35 years. It's a mandatory course. 300 kids take it every year. They come in for their first year of philosophy and they have to take Introduction to Logic. And we teach a very standard logic course, syntax, semantics, first semantics, then syntax. We teach natural deduction. We teach truth tables, the regular Introduction to Logic course. Usually on the second day, the second class, we give the definition of validity. Again, very standard definition. We say validity is truth preserving. If the premises are true, the conclusion has to be true, and we go on. And this was working fine for the first few decades that I taught it. And what we have noticed, what I've noticed in the past 10 years, is that when I say, here is validity, it's not, is the statement true or false, but given that premises are true, the conclusion has to be true, somebody will raise their hand and say, true according to who? And that's a new cultural phenomenon. These are relativistic kids, or these are kids who have grown up in a relativistic environment. And it has something to do, obviously, with cultural relativism. All right, so that was just my introductory story. This is a very long article, so I will maybe skip certain parts, and then during the discussion, they'll probably come in. I've got four chapters, sort of chapters. Relativism and cultural relativism. I want to try to not define, but at least identify what it is that we're talking about. Then Wittgenstein and the cultural relativists. There are a few heroes that I think of as the paradigmatic cultural relativists, not necessarily in philosophy. Then Wittgenstein as a cultural relativist. And finally, I will finish off with hopefully giving my idea of where I would place Wittgenstein, but I'm still working on that. I haven't decided. I can give the hint right now that I borrow the label from Clifford Geertz and I call Wittgenstein an anti-relativist, which does not mean that he is a cultural relativist. All right, so what is relativism and what is cultural relativism? On the former, what is relativism? I can't in good conscience spend time now except to mention some pertinent insights, pertinent for us with Wittgenstein. First, relativism is importantly a denial of prestigious and mostly traditional isms. It's a denial of universalism, objectivism, absolutism, and monism. There might be others, but those are the ones that I engage with. So it's not it's against, coming out against universalism, against objectivism, against absolutism, and against monism. This insight is important because if accepted, it puts into the relativist camp several philosophies and philosophers who indeed deny various positions and views but might not accept the label of relativism. Not only is there a point of nuance here, but perhaps a requirement that in speaking of relativism, we should supply something positive. What is relativism rather than merely a negative? What is it not? But that something positive is, of course, complex to the point of convolution. Syntactically, we can say that relativism proclaims an X relative to Y, but the range of X's and Y's in the philosophical tradition talking about relativism is astoundingly wide. We talk of measuring truth or reference or values, the X's, as relative to language, culture, individuals, times, places, etc. That's the Y's. Attempts at organizing these various forms of relativism are profligate. So I'll just mention Susan Hack, for instance, but I'll just mention her. She's got a list. I think it's a list of 9 or 10 different X relative to Y. So it's reference relative to language and values relative to, and the word culture doesn't show up in what she says there. But she's got an organized list. So the nice thing about it is that it's very organized. If you want to talk about relativism, you look at Susan Hack's table. Despite the multiplicity and convolution, I think there is reason to identify grosso modo different relativisms rather than different claims of relativism, since there's substantial fundamentals that have to do with the labelings. So in short, let's mention a few basic relativisms in order to narrow in on cultural relativisms. First, in the factors to be relativized, we talk of cognitive, moral, or aesthetic relativisms. Giving us cognitive, moral, and aesthetic values, not only values, X's that have to be put relative to Y. Without stopping here, immediately you ask what the cognitive, moral, or aesthetic values are being relativized to, and the three that I think I see most, or the four, are subjective relativism, cultural, usually dichotomized into social or historical, and conceptual. So that's, when I think of relativism, I think of relative to someone, and that's subjectivism, relative to a certain culture. Sometimes we talk about history, sometimes about society when we say culture, and conceptual relativism. I think a lot of amazing work has been done on conceptual relativism, but that's not what we are here. And of course, Davidson, Putnam, the whole bunch of them. All right, so I won't go into elaboration of all of these. The important thing is cultural relativism maintains that the truth and falsity of our beliefs, the rightness and wrongness of our actions, and the justification for our claims are dependent on, in other words, relative to certain cultural conditions involving social norms and conventions. That's almost a definition. And I think it's fine. It's not. We can argue about little things there, but I think that's basically what we always want to say. And this last is the one that is attributed to, when it is attributed to, Wittgenstein. All right? So the truth and falsity of our beliefs, rightness and wrongness of our actions, justification for our claims, are dependent on, relative to certain cultural conditions that have social norms and conventions in them. Just one note about relativism in general. Relativism is a philosophical stance before we delve into cultural relativism. Whether we encounter the relativism versus universalism, or relativism versus objectivism, or relativism versus monism, or relativism versus absolutism debate, the philosophical arguments on both sides are usually logical and argumentative. I'm using the word argumentative positively. They use good arguments, but sometimes it becomes a play, a game. For instance, I love, but I really do not much treasure, the debate that goes the following way. The relativist accuses any self-described absolutist position of being relative to its holder's context. So any absolutist that comes out with a good theory is immediately accused of holding that theory relative to your own language, culture, conceptual scheme, etc. And the absolutist responds with the allegation that the relativist has accepted his own ism, relativism, as an absolute. And I see that argument coming up in so many places. It's a game, but I think it's no more than a game. It's a fun game, but it's no more than a game. We similarly see Alistair MacIntyre making a short but very strong claim, which I'll just finish with because I think that is, as I said, strong, I'm not sure, very convincing. This is MacIntyre, quote, "Relativism, like skepticism, is one of those doctrines that have by now been refuted a number of times too often. Nothing is perhaps a surer sign that a doctrine embodies some not to be neglected truth than that in the course of the history of philosophy, it should have been refuted again and again. Genuinely refutable doctrines need only be refuted once."
Okay. Where's that from?
Relativism, Power, and Philosophy. It's in 1985. The APA, when he gave the big talk at the APA. All right, so I leave that general question of relativism behind and go on exclusively to cultural relativism. And let's start with the cultural relativists. The natural place to talk about cultural relativism is in the discipline of anthropology. It's by definition that anthropology investigates cultures. It is an internal disciplinary question among anthropologists whether that investigation is motivated by a view to general scientific theories about cultures, even if it's a comparative theory, it's a general theoretical theory about cultures, or to particular descriptive reportage of cultures, relatively. In gross generalization, one can say that anthropology at the beginning of the 20th century was science-oriented, with a view to grand theories of culture. And it is, of course, in Fraser's Golden Bough that one can locate the definitive moment in the cultural and historical understanding that the Western world had of other cultures, communities, and societies. Other. The whole point was that these were other cultures. They weren't using the word other then. That came, I think, in the 70s. But the point was that we in the West are looking at other cultures, other both geographically and historically. Fraser plotted the road from the primitive first stage of magic to the modern last stage of science, with religion somewhere in between. This is, of course, something that we'll get to in a minute with Wittgenstein, because Wittgenstein wrote about Fraser. I don't have time to go through the whole Fraser theory. That book, The Golden Bough, which I remember getting as a present when I was 10, and it was a big fat book. It was originally 20 volumes, something crazy, then went down to 12 volumes, came out first in 1890, then in 1916. It was the magnus opus of what anthropology should do. But it was a scientific theory, and it was a progressive theory. First, there are societies focused on, constituted by magic, then religion, and then science. And it's a very fascinating plot of how we moved from magic to religion to science. Again, we moved conceptually, socially, culturally, not historically. Historically, even though we are now at the scientific age, there still are societies which are in the magical stage, and definitely others that are at the religion stage. We should talk about that a lot, actually. This connects to what I talked about. All right, so it's astoundingly Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein is an anthropologist, is a philosopher of anthropology, who says in 1931, in no uncertain terms, that Fraser's account of the magical and religious views of mankind is unsatisfactory. And at first, Wittgenstein is gentle, unsatisfactory. But then he charges relentlessly that Fraser's attempt to explain religious practice is, quote, wrong. Here one can only describe and say, this is what human life is like. You can't give me maps and theories. You can only say, this is what human life is like. Relentlessly, he keeps on charging that, quote, Fraser himself, and this is the famous quote, is much more savage than most of his savages. For they are not as far removed from the understanding of a spiritual matter as a 20th century Englishman. His explanations of primitive practices are much cruder than the meaning of these practices themselves, end of quote. But the famous thing is that Fraser is more savage than the savage cultures that he is describing. In this attack on Fraser, accompanied by a tolerance of primitive societies, explicitly disdaining the English understanding of those societies, dare we say colonialism, a first inkling of cultural relativism attributed to Wittgenstein is found. Let's leave anthropology for a moment and widen our access to social sciences in general. We'll shortly return to anthropology. And let's get to Wittgenstein's influence on social scientists, on those who interrogate the very idea of a social science. And I emphasize both of those, an idea of a social science. The two heroes here are Peter Winch and Ernest Gellner, the relativist and the universalist. And again, this is, it might sound to some like old hat. This was going on in the 60s and 70s, and really talking to people who were thinking in terms of the 50s. I find it still very fascinating. So in 64, Peter Winch wrote an article, Understanding a Primitive Society, but put to use a detailed interpretation of Wittgenstein on Fraser's positivistic historical view of primitive or other societies. So Winch is taking Wittgenstein's side against Fraser and trying to understand what Wittgenstein was saying. In a sense, this was an early anthropological rather than philosophical heeding of Wittgenstein's reproach of our cultural egocentrism. What Winch was putting to use was a very comprehensive interpretation of Wittgenstein, which he himself had expounded earlier in his famous 1958 book, The Idea of a Social Science, and which presented the first thorough reading of Wittgenstein on social science. Notwithstanding qualifications and caveats concerning the lack of anything explicit on social science in Wittgenstein's words. So it's not that Wittgenstein ever said anything about social science. It's that Peter Winch, who is a grand social scientist, is interpreting and using Wittgenstein to talk about social science and saying that the way we do social science should be a Wittgensteinian way. This was very revolutionary. It was a groundbreaking achievement within the world of social science, part of a common and verily communal attempt by several thinkers at the beginning of the second half of the 20th century to change the focus and conceptual armament of the social sciences by, in no meager words, depriving them of the status of science. That was the big thing. Winch's contribution, other than being an influential tractate of rethinking the social sciences, was additionally philosophically grounded by Wittgenstein. The attitude to language, for instance, is not the superficial lip service type of expression asking for linguistic rather than realistic discussions of phenomena, but rather a deep understanding of Wittgenstein admonishing us that, quote, our idea of what belongs to the realm of reality is given for us in the language that we use. This is Winch paraphrasing Wittgenstein. Again, the idea of what belongs to the realm of reality is given to us in the language that we use. I mean, that is really, it sounds so current, but this is in the 50s. Winch proceeds to use Wittgenstein's words on language, which he has interpreted, and his analysis of human rule-following behavior in order to better explain the normative basics of social science. And this means talking about the nature of meaningful behavior, the links between mind and society, and the elusive interrelations between concepts and actions. These basics, when mined meaningfully, exhibit a character which distances them from what is usually meant by science, and what for Winch brings the social sciences nearer to philosophy. Okay, so this is an attack on social science being a science, and you're trying to figure out where to put it. First of all, you bring it closer to philosophy. Winch says, quote, science, unlike philosophy, this is the old type of science, is wrapped up in its own way of making things intelligible to the exclusion of all others. Or rather, it applies its criteria unself-consciously. For to be self-conscious about such matters is to be philosophical. This non-philosophical unself-consciousness is for the most part right and proper in the investigation of nature, but it is disastrous in the investigation of a human society whose very nature is to consist in different and competing ways of life, each offering a different account of the intelligibility of things. So I think you can hear Wittgenstein speaking there. He doesn't say forms of life, he says ways of life. End of quote. What ensues, therefore, in the social sciences is a very different way and method of investigation, geared towards understanding rather than explaining in the old way of doing so, statistically, predictively, empirically, and never losing sight of the subjective and self-constrained perspective of the investigator. Quote from Winch again, Wittgenstein says somewhere that when we get into philosophical difficulties over the use of some of the concepts of our language, we're like savages confronted with something from an alien culture. I am simply indicating a corollary of this, that sociologists who misinterpret an alien culture are like philosophers getting into difficulties over the use of their own concepts. So this is a way of doing social science. Well, that's the relativist. Now is the time to bring in Ernest Gellner. Not for his role as a Wittgenstein interpreter, he was not, neither for his notorious attack on Wittgenstein as setting the stage for what he saw as the downfall of serious philosophical endeavor, that is linguistic analytic philosophy. So Gellner had it in for Wittgenstein for destroying analytic philosophy. This is interesting. I think Hintikka has a much more recent article, whose was the hand who killed analytic philosophy? And he blames Wittgenstein, the later Wittgenstein. Okay, so this is Gellner much earlier doing this. But no, that's not what Gellner is doing here. He has active He has acute perceptions of how Wittgenstein interpreters or anyone working under Wittgensteinian auspices misunderstood the essence of social science. So he's defending social science against Winch and these Wittgensteinians. Gellner will not accept Wittgenstein's position on the social sciences, and if Wittgenstein did not have an explicit position on the social sciences, if indeed it's only the interpretations of Wittgenstein that allows one to say these Wittgensteinian things about the social sciences, then so much the worse for the interpreters and for Wittgenstein himself. Gellner sees some Wittgensteinians, like Winch, as presenting us with a narrow cocoon-like model of society, or different societies, while others like A.R. Lauch, who in 66 wrote a book called Explanation and Human Action, who draw a wider diversity style draft. So either you have these little insular things or the big multicultural draft things. The upshot in Gellner's part is vehement, quote, "From the viewpoint of a real working sociologist, the moral of it all is this. There's not really any substantial difference between what these various Wittgensteinians say about the social sciences, great as the differences may seem to them. They all highlight the meaningful nature of conduct, where the meaning of an action is its place, its function within a language, a form of life, a culture." But for Gellner, and I continue the quote, "the correct view, at a low level of civilization, characterized above all by traditional primitive thought, explanations do indeed often tend to be ad hoc, context relevant, heterogeneous in logic. Civilization, though, the development of thought and the emergence of science, on the other hand, are characterized by generalizing scientific thought, by the increase in relative importance of explanations which are general and context free. The requirement of context freedom is dictated not merely by logic, but equally by the instability of contexts. Sociology is born of the attempt to understand this flux, as well as from the simple extension of the ideal of general explanation to human conduct." And Gellner concludes with his, as always, negative appraisal of Wittgenstein in general. "The apotheosis of the untidy, the ad hoc, the context-bound, and the denial of generality in science and human affairs are all parts of one big and unacceptable paradox. The matter is really simple. Wittgenstein supposed that this plurality and disparity, or rather its recognition, somehow solved something and absolved us from the unnecessary and self-imposed burden of seeking general validations. In fact, it does nothing of the kind. Used in that way, his discovery seems to me to have little merit. If treated as a problem, not as a solution, the idea becomes significant." All right, so the point is that all of this mess, as he calls it, messy, ad hoc, context dependency, is a problem. But you can't give that as the solution. And we as sociologists or social sciences have to solve this problem. He starts, by the way, this is just a side comment, of course, very famously, an article on relativism with the words, "A specter haunts human thought. Relativism. If truth has many faces, then not one of them deserves trust or respect." Right, so this is drawing on a lot of things that we know. I've brought Winch and Gellner to bear on Wittgenstein and cultural relativism. Not Wittgenstein as a cultural relativist, but what Wittgenstein and the cultural relativists do to each other. Since both of them, Winch and Gellner, recognize Wittgenstein as a relativist, they differ only in their acceptance or denial of relativism as the proper philosophy of social sciences. But since we started with a very scientistic Fraser, let's end this chapter with one more anthropologist, to my mind, the greatest of them all, who connects anthropology to philosophy via Wittgenstein, but a little differently. I'm talking, of course, of Clifford Geertz, who brings us closer to our interest in Wittgenstein himself, rather than to how others see him, by spelling out exactly what it is in and from Wittgenstein that he has adopted, yea, embraced, as an anthropologist. Like a shopping list, he expounds on important Wittgensteinianisms. And the list that he gives is the following. It'll be very familiar to you. This is the list of things that bring Wittgenstein closer to Geertz as an anthropologist. The attack on the idea of a private language, the notion of a language game, following a rule, don't look for the meaning, look for the use, a whole cloud of philosophy condensed into a drop of grammar, saying and showing, family resemblance, a picture held as captive, seeing as, stand not quite there, back to the rough ground, aspect blindness, my spade is turned. Okay, so these are, they're all, you know, classical slogans, but Geertz takes every single one of them seriously, claiming that these serviced, quote, a critique of philosophy that rather narrowed the gap between it, between philosophy, and going about in the world, trying to discover how in the midst of talk, people, groups of people, individual people, people as a whole, put a distinct and variegated voice together. End of Gellner's quote in the book Available Light. Sounds very prophetic, sort of. Available Light, I mean, think of what he's saying about himself. Whether Geertz himself is really a relativist is an open question, answered oh so slyly in his famous anti-anti-relativism, to which I hope to return. That he finds succor in Wittgenstein is clear. Okay, so I'm not saying yet whether Winch is a relativist or not, but it's clear that he adopts Wittgenstein. He thinks of himself almost as Wittgenstein. Okay, so that's Wittgenstein and the social relativists. Now, Wittgenstein himself as a cultural relativist. It's almost criminal to say, I think, Wittgenstein as something or other. Looking at Sarah here, in most cases, Wittgenstein is realist, Wittgenstein is anti-realist, Wittgenstein as solipsist, Wittgenstein as positivist. It's really criminal to do that. The potentiality of finding evidence for any position and its contradictory in Wittgenstein's writing is of known infamy. Still would like to present a general, largely consensual, not completely, but largely consensual reading of certain parts of the Nachlass that bring out the reasons for the temptation to see him as a relativist, cultural or other. We're obviously speaking here of the later Wittgenstein. Without going here into the quagmire of the recently popularized, I believe, Alois doesn't, that he's recently abandoned new Wittgenstein, without going to that agenda, and that agenda, of course, amalgamates the two or even three Wittgensteins into one, let me simply reiterate the standard reading that sees the early Wittgenstein as a realist, admitting a world out there to be perceived, thought about, and talked about in a representative language and a language of thought. There is, I think, nary a hint of relativism in the early Wittgenstein. I don't know, maybe if we do find relativism there, but I think you're with that too. So it's not the early Wittgenstein that we're talking about. I think it would be fascinating to look for relativism in the early Wittgenstein. It would be a new way of looking. But beginning with what has been called the middle Wittgenstein, obviously in the writings of later Wittgenstein, and including the currently popular third Wittgenstein, we encounter a set of concepts, ideas, intuitions, and insights buttressed by a motley of quotes that establish the general atmosphere supporting Wittgenstein as cultural relativist. So much so, by the way, that in a book called Relativism by Maria Bagramian that basically tells the story of relativism from ancient times till today, there's a chapter on current sources of culture of relativism, and she talks about postmodernism, about positivism, and about Wittgenstein. So Wittgenstein gets a subchapter to himself. She doesn't do that with other philosophers. Others are isms. But there's Wittgenstein as a source of current cultural relativism. Okay, so what are these concepts, ideas, intuitions, and insights? Meaning is defined, of course, for a large class of cases, but not tellingly for me, for all, as the meaning of a word is its use in the language, PI 43, of course. And that turn to use immediately lands us in the arena of context, since use is dependent on speaker, hearer, motivation, place, time, etc. Furthermore, the investigation of linguistic communication points to a rule-governed social activity. So rule-governed, of course, is following a rule, and social is, of course, the ante to private language. So we've got a rule-governed social activity, simply a language game, and the language games of this purpose of social activity are, as is well known, embedded in a cultural and biological setting, a form of life. And that is at the basis of everything, PI on page 226, what has to be accepted, the given is, so one could say, forms of life. Okay, so these are very famous quotes. And these are the basics almost to the tune of mantras. The move from these basics to the label of relativism is natural and I think should have been expected. It's not surprising that these were monopolized and taken over. If the meanings of words and the possibility of communication are use-driven, that is context-dependent, and if the rules of our language games are socially, that is culturally determined by the forms of life which harbor them, then it's foolhardy to think that we could have identified objective or universal or absolute criteria for understanding. Wittgenstein says, I want to say, an education quite different from ours might also be the foundation for quite different concepts, for here life would run on differently. This is from Zettel. I think it's a beautiful quote. Understanding not only our day-to-day words, which you might have attributed this quote to just day-to-day words, we might have had different concepts if we had a different education, a different life. Understanding not only those kind of concepts, but even those terms which we had thought of as being foundational and above or below ordinary referential concepts. We have to think even of our basic semantic and local terminology, formerly thought to anchor the very possibility of communication as dependent on our forms of life, on our form of life, sorry. Even ideas like truth, necessity, rationality, logic itself, maybe even those concepts are dependent on our form of life. And Wittgenstein says in remarks on Foundation of Mathematics, quote, then according to you, everybody could continue the series as he likes, and so infer anyhow? In that case, we shan't call it, quote, continuing the series, and also presumably not inference. And thinking and inferring, like counting, is of course bounded for us, not by an arbitrary definition, but by natural limits corresponding to the body of what can be called the role of thinking and inferring in our life. Again, he doesn't say form of life there, but it is in our life. Importantly, not only are there several forms of life that are familiar to us or that we can imagine, but even our own form of life is liable to change. And again, that change might be a change that impacts our most basic thought processes. Quote from the Philosophical Remarks, indeed, even at this stage, I predict a time when there will be mathematical investigations of calculi containing contradictions, and people will actually be proud of having emancipated themselves even from consistence. I just say, no way he could be saying this, but of course he does. All right, so we might even give up on consistency. And he says he predicts a time when that might happen. Just as significant is the social or communal aspect of forms of life. We're not a bunch of atoms, each inhabiting a bubble and enacting his or her own meanings. That might have spoken to the relativism that I've called subjectivism, a very different type of relativism. No, we function as members of human constituencies, call them cultures, that are natural human phenomena, forms of life. The additional element, and a large element it is, of these Wittgensteinian refrains that conduces to relativism is his so-called metaphilosophy, enjoining us to focus on the particular rather than the general, and the descriptive rather than the explanatory. This turn to individual stories, particular events, and most important, diversely specific uses of words puts shame to the old, age-old philosophical quest for one enveloping theory of anything. All right, so we've got here the communal thing, the meta-philosophy of describe rather than explain, and of course the meaning is use, the context dependencies. Three elements that make him a relativist. In other words, it's a three-pronged trajectory, which we identify in so many of Wittgenstein's comments, that has moved so many readers of Wittgenstein to see him as a cultural relativist. On the one hand, beyond so many sporadic quotes, I accept that this general mood that seems to bespeak relativism, and that is certainly antagonistic to traditional or positivistic or absolutist philosophy, goes a long way towards grounding the relativistic character of Wittgenstein's thought. And yet, on the other hand, despite this convincing barrage of infamous and unsettling quips, it takes putting these words into a Wittgensteinian context, rather than mood, to disparage that easy relativism. So I'm saying there's a relativistic character and mood here to these things, but that it might not be real relativism. And doing so, disparaging the easy relativism here, requires first investigating yet again that elusive concept, form of life. And I talk of form of life, previously I've talked of the difference between form of life and language game. I don't have the time to go into that, but I'm insisting on form of life here. The main point about forms of life that services the relativist position is their insularity, their supposed incommensurability. If our words and our concepts get their meanings only by functioning in specific forms of life, then the uses of the same words in distinctive contexts that would enable communication between and across these forms of life belie that precise description, the same words. How would we know that we're using the same word if we're using it in different contexts that give it different meanings? Also, fundamental beliefs in our rationality, our logical presuppositions, our communicative capabilities are suspect and prone to the same paradoxical angst mentioned above. Even our very rationality and logic are entrenched in and a result of a particular form of life which invigorates them. It is this reading of forms of life that is upheld by all relativist reading of Wittgenstein. I venture, however, that a limited appraisal of forms of life as potentially disconnected was just the initial step in Wittgenstein's unearthing of this critical construct. Yes, we're all in different and perhaps widely disparate forms of life, and yes, it may be a challenging project to translate and communicate across different forms of life. The point I would like to emphasize, however, is that the plurality of even insular to a point forms of life does not contradict the fact, and I think this is a Wittgensteinian fact, that these are all human forms of life. I lean here on two philosophers, Oswald Hanfling and Newton Garver. Hanfling has written a book called Wittgenstein and the Human Form of Life. Hanfling makes it clear that Wittgenstein himself nowhere says human form of life. These are literally Hanfling's words, which are based, however, on Wittgenstein's description of human to form of life. Nowhere, indeed, does Wittgenstein explicitly credit our common form of life as one human form of life, but he rather gives hints and suggestions that describe our natural history, our human biology, even our instinctive understandings as what makes us commonly and mutually human. And in one of the few, I think we count five or six, I'm not sure, the few times that forms of life is mentioned, that's an interesting interpretive thing. Why is it that these five, six times have been made so much of. But in one of those places, Wittgenstein supplies the following fascinating comment, quote, "Can only those hope who can talk, only those who have mastered the use of a language." That is to say, the phenomena of hope are modes of this complicated form of life. This, for me, means this human, complicated form of life. And this form of life is what is characteristic only of those who can talk, and hope inheres only in those who can talk. I think that's amazing. Newton Garver has shown in his book called This Complicated Form of Life, he takes it from that quote, this complicated form of life can only be a human form of life, a language-using form of life. Such acknowledgement of both difference, complication, and a certain universalism makes room then for the existence of distinct forms of life, whether in different cultures, for different persons, or even, I dare say, in one individual's life, but also for communication, that is, human communication between these different forms of life. The case of religion and religious form of life is instructive, by the way. Wittgenstein's lectures on religious belief has indeed been taken by many to mean that the secular person talking about the supposedly same things that the religion person is talking about is not really talking about the same things. The religious person, says this fideistic reading of Wittgenstein, and the faithless are not speaking the same language, even though their words may seem identical. They're playing different language games and partaking in different forms of life. But I dare say it is precisely the ongoing conversation, argument, debate, even to the level of war. I swear I wrote this before last week. Even to the level of war on religion and between religions that act as evidence of a common human basis, a human form of life that permits this communication. In other words, that debate, that war between religion and non-religion happens because we are in a human form of life communicating about it. So I don't agree to that fideistic reading of Wittgenstein, that these are two forms of life that don't talk the same language. Indeed, the very quote that is usually used to celebrate relativist readings of Wittgenstein is seen now to lead to the opposite conclusion. Quote, "So you're saying that human agreement decides what is true and what is false? It is what human beings say that is true and false, and they agree in the language they use. That is not agreement in opinions, but in form of life." So I think this is almost unequivocal. This is PI 241. Yes.
Does he say human there?
It is what human beings say that is true and false, and they agree in the language they use.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. So it's not the human language, but humans agree in the language they use. Okay, thanks. "The secular and the religious persons and persons of all other disputes may disagree, but they speak the same language or a potentially translatable language by partaking in a human form of life. Quote, if language is a means of communication, there must be agreement, not only in definitions, but also, queer as this may sound, in judgments." And that's just the continuation of the same quote, end of quote. And this doesn't mean judgment of truth and falsity, by the way. It's not Fregean judgment. Judgment is something deeper. It comes before assessment of something being true or false. "We share a form of life. That is why," Wittgenstein says, "if a lion could speak, we could not understand him." This is crucial. Lions and all other animals have forms of life diametrically unlike human forms of life. If we understand one another, it is because we are humans, the other understanding species. In parentheses, I said, but I think maybe it shouldn't be in parentheses. "Humans may kill each other in battle, but humans and lions kill each other not in battle." I hope I know what I meant. There is an important nuance here that I find in uncertainty. 6.11 and 6.12. Wittgenstein says, quote, "Where two principles really do meet, which cannot be reconciled with one another, then each man declares the other a fool and a heretic. I said I would combat in scare quotes, the other man, but wouldn't I give him reasons? Certainly, but how far do they go? At the end of reasons comes persuasion. Think what happens when missionaries convert natives." Now, I take this as bespeaking a human commonality rather than a relativism. Stanley Cavell says it differently. In a wonderfully conceived discussion about the chicken and the egg of agreement and language. If language is a consequence of social agreement between humans, how could we have achieved agreement without language? He explains that we have been in agreement all along. The quote from Stanley Cavell, "For nothing is deeper than the fact or the extent of agreement itself." This is a claim of reason. Okay, so that's Wittgenstein as cultural relativist. I think he's not. I think there's reason to get into the mood and character of cultural relativism, but I think he is insisting on a human form of life, which cannot, in the end, conduce to real relativism. I'll finish off with Wittgenstein as anti-relativist. So how to weather the insistence on the particular, the admonition that all we can do is assemble reminders in PI 127, the cry to beware of the craving for generality from the Blue Book, and still insist on a Wittgenstein who recognizes some version of the universal. Remember that it was not just the concept, not just the construct of perhaps insular, perhaps uncommunicating forms of life that stimulated the idea of a Wittgensteinian cultural relativist. It was also his metaphilosophy, bidding us to distance ourselves from the absolutist, or at the least the generalist theoretical ways of doing philosophy that had traditionally been anathema to relativism. This is where I'd like to return to anthropology and connect it to philosophy as done by Geertz. In an amazingly philosophical article And Geertz is forever talking about the affinity between philosophy and anthropology, anti-relativism. Geertz mounts an attack on anti-relativism without ever letting it be a defense of relativism. The double negative, he says, doesn't work as a positive. Coming out against anti-relativism does not mean that one is wholeheartedly committed to relativism. By the way, he draws a fascinating parallel between anti-relativism and the historical phenomenon of anti-communism, but that's something else. It only obligates one to argue with the regular anti-relativists. In our case, the universalists, who are usually thought of as cultural colonialists, the absolutists, who might be cultural dictators, or the monists, who might be cultural provincials. Geertz goes on to extol the virtues, but more than that, the human necessity of pluralism and tolerance that can only be attained through an understanding of cultures, many cultures, all cultures, especially cultures different than our own. Beyond the list of Wittgensteinianisms that Geertz has given that we mentioned above, and that are usually associated with cultural relativism, Geertz had described anthropologists, or is it philosophers, like we said above, going about in the world trying to discover how in the midst of talk, people, groups of people, individual people, people as a whole, put a distinct and variegated voice together. Notice here that the distinct and variegated voice may be of individuals, might be of groups, but can also be of people as a whole. Humans, who are people as a whole, put a distinct and variegated voice together. But Geertz, the anti-relativist, will not adopt an ism describing this voice. Wittgenstein, frustratingly perhaps, similarly teaches us how to eschew all isms, to cease arguing for or against relativism, for or against solipsism, for or against Platonism, since that kind of traditional philosophical argument misses the mark. Instead, we should, in the matter of anthropologists, but not cultural relativists, describe the multiplicity of human behavior and human language. Could it be that we should give up philosophy for Geertzian anthropology? I doubt it. I think it rather goes the other way around. I think we can learn from anthropologists when we do philosophy, but as Geertz says about that certain brand of anthropologists, quote, they have, wonder of wonders, been speaking Wittgenstein all along. Thanks.